This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hi there, welcome to another vacation show of Radio EcoShock. After a few words about a video lecture update on the latest climate science by Dr. Richard Alley, you will hear the awful truth about rising seas around the world. Francesca Rhiannon, host of Writer's Voice, interviews scientist Brian Fagan, author of The Attacking Ocean. We'll wrap up with my own interview of Allison Martin from the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. Yep, we'll talk about the Tennessee fainting goat and the need to keep up the biodiversity of your food chain. Dr. Richard Alley is one of America's best-known and most-cited climate scientists. Actually, he was trained as a geologist and teaches at Pennsylvania State University. Alley chaired a U.S. government panel on abrupt climate change. He has testified to Congress and written for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He specializes in melting ice at the poles. Richard Alley has given an update called The State of the Climate System 2013 at a special conference of the American Geophysical Union. It was held in Colorado at the beginning of June. I recommend you spend about 45 minutes of your valuable time watching the video of Alley's presentation. Find the link in my show blog at ecoshock.info or just search for State of the Climate System and Chapman. I'll squeeze in a couple of fast observations about this talk. First, Alley does a simple job of explaining the complex relationship between heat in the atmosphere and the heating of the ocean. Although our emissions have been increasing exponentially, most of that extra heat held in by the greenhouse gases has gone into the ocean. That is because during the last decade, a period of cooler ocean water in the Pacific, called La Niña, has dominated. A cooler ocean surface will soak up more heat from the air. Expect different results when we get more of the hotter ocean in El Niño during that cycle. Check out Richard Alley's charts on the heat tolerance of our major food crops like corn, wheat, and rice. We are already above their optimum growing conditions. Actual production figures show that countries hit with just a very few hot days at the critical periods suffered a loss in food production. It's even possible, Alley says, by the year 2100 that parts of the planet may become too hot for unprotected humans and other large mammals to survive. It's also been shown that human productivity, that important economic indicator, drops as the weather becomes hotter, so we will have less energy to deal with greater problems of the future. Alley's speech shines when he enters his field of expertise, the melting polar ice. For once, there is a little bit of good news. Those pundits and those few scientists who suggested Greenland's ice cap may quickly slide into the sea are mistaken, Alley says. Yes, giant new lakes of meltwater are forming in Greenland during the summer. Yes, they can rather suddenly drain down to the depths of the glaciers. But the land under the glaciers is not a nice even slope towards the sea. There are mountains and ridges down there which he claims precludes or prevents a sudden slide off of ice. Dr. Alley suggests it will take at least hundreds, if not more than 1,000 years, to melt the Greenland ice cap, almost no matter how hot the climate gets. The same is not true of the ice sheets of Antarctica. Many of these have spread from the land-based ice cap out over the sea. There are several unstable areas around the Antarctic Peninsula which contain enough ice to add several meters or more to sea levels. The good news is they are melting slowly so far, but that could change, and scientists are monitoring them closely with real concern. Richard Alley seems almost optimistic about the next 30 years or so. He wonders if we haven't already seen the worst impacts of climate change for the first half of this century. After that, almost all climate science indicates a rapid deterioration with lots of heating after 2050. If we believe Richard Alley, our children and grandchildren will experience frightening changes while we continue to coast along with some problems and damages in our fossil fuel-powered society. With all due respect to Richard Alley, I'm not sure I believe that. Pretty well every prediction that was supposed to happen by 2050, according to bodies like the IPCC, are already surfacing now, way ahead of predictions. Don't miss it. Search for State of the Climate System and Chapman, or find the link in my blog at ecoshock.info. Now let's dig deeper into the creeping destabilizer, which at least one U.S. military authority thinks is the greatest threat of climate change. Rising seas will remove parts of the world from Florida to Bangladesh right off the map. Most of the world's major cities from Shanghai to New York will be flooded, bit by bit, storm by storm. Francesca Rhiannon interviewed the author of a new book, The Attacking Ocean. She's agreed to this rebroadcast of her Writer's Voice program, first put out on Pacifica on June 26, 2013.
This isn't the first time humans have confronted rising sea levels.
Eventually, Doggerland vanished and the people moved up to high ground. This is very, very different from a situation today where you have millions of people living in cities like Shanghai who are faced with the same problem. What do you do?
That's Brian Fagan. We'll talk with him about his book, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Pity the poor residents of coastal North Carolina. Not only are they vulnerable to rising seas that will flood many of their communities, but their state government isn't even allowed to take the impact of climate change on sea levels into account. That's because the state legislature has passed what you could call the stick our fingers in our ears and chant la 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 law. They voted last July to forbid studies predicting a rapid rise in sea level because of climate change from being included in planning for sea level rise. But New York's Mayor Bloomberg has taken a different tack. Speaking at the Brooklyn Navy Yard June 11th, he announced a $20 billion plan to protect the city from rising sea levels due to global warming, levels that could reach as much as 2 meters, that's over 6 feet, by century's end. New York isn't the only city so threatened, of course. Miami may in fact be the U.S. city most threatened by sea level rise. In fact, by 2100, large parts of Florida may be underwater, and the entire country of Bangladesh is at risk. It isn't the first time humans have confronted changes in sea level, but it is the first time so many people have lived in fixed communities so close to rising seas. My guest, archaeologist and anthropologist Brian Fagan, has devoted a good portion of the last few decades to writing about climate changes in history. We last spoke to him about his 2008 book, The Great Warming, about the medieval warming period. Now he's come out with The Attacking Ocean. It's about sea level rise, past, present, and future. Brian Fagan, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, it's nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
This is a scary title, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. It's a very rich book. It goes into history, the science, geology. And I'd like to just kind of start with the science. One of the things you talk about in the book, The Attacking Ocean, is that there have been various eras of sea level rise. I mean, I think most of us think that, you know, there was the glaciers, and then the glaciers started to melt, and sea level rise was kind of inexorable since then. And then, you know, maybe it stabilized at a certain point when the, you know, the whole climate stabilized, and now we're starting again because of human-caused, anthropogenic global warming. But it's a little more complicated than that.
It is, because what you've got are all sorts of different factors playing on the level of the ocean. One of them, of course, is melting ice, as you point out. Then there is the much more complicated, or even more complicated, issue of the Earth's crust adjusting to the reduced weight of ice on the land. And this weight can really make a difference in one area from another. So it's very difficult to say that a sea level was at a certain level. You can say it for one place, but you may not even be able to say it from a place 10 miles away. Then on top of that, you've got temperature changes, constant adjustments in climate, which go on all the time. But basically, it is safe to say that from about 6,000 years ago up till the Industrial Revolution, things kind of stabilized and there were very relatively minor changes.
And Why exactly was there a previous warming? Why did we come out of the glacier, the ice age?
Came out about, well, it kind of then depends how you define it, but in round figures, at the really significant warming started about 15,000 years ago. It was rather irregular. There was a period and about 13,000 years ago when there was a 1,000-year virtual return to glacial conditions. But since about 10,000 years ago, we've had a much more stable climate. We've had one of the most stable periods of climate for a long, long time, with a trend towards slight warming and then stabilization of sea levels.
Yeah, and so I guess my question is, why did that warming happen originally? I mean, you're talking about the 10,000 periods that coincided with the rise of human civilization.
You got these natural cycles of cold and warm, which go back about 750,000 years, maybe more, where typically you get a gradual cooling to a glacial condition, and then you get a rapid warming. And the periods of warming called interglacials last shorter times than the periods of colder climate. And the last glaciation, which began, I think, about 130,000 years ago, ended about 15,000 years ago. And if one was talking about a conventional sort of irregular climate cycles, we would now be in the probably closing stages of an interglacial, of a warmer period. But what's happened is that human action has intervened, and the warming appears to be continuing.
You write in the book about this phenomenon of the Gulf Stream. What role does that play?
The Gulf Stream is terribly important for European climate because it brings warmer water up towards Europe. And this has the effect of ameliorating climate temperatures in Europe with the westerly winds. And when you get the Gulf Stream shutting down or closing, as happened 1,000 years ago, virtually shut down about 13,000 years ago, you get much colder conditions in Europe. And that's what happened for 1,000 years. And then the upwelling that circulates the Gulf Stream suddenly resumed, and things warmed up very rapidly.
And I understand that the Gulf Stream is slowing down again, and that it may even be slowing down precisely because, or ironically, because of global warming. Can you elucidate what's going on right now with the Gulf Stream, and what are the implications? Is that what's implicated in, you know, the cold European winter this year, or is that going to mean Europe's going to have an ice age while the rest of us broil? How's that going to work out?
We don't know. All of this is kind of theoretical in a way. There is a scenario which says that you've got water, fresh water cascading over the North Atlantic as a result of the melting of ice in Greenland and elsewhere. And this is going to shut down, at least partially, the circulation of the Gulf Stream. And there are people who are saying this may be happening. If that happened, theoretically, we could be plunged into a fairly prolonged period of extremely cold climate, which would be, in its effects, global. It wouldn't just be Europe. And one of the most important effects, judging from the last one in 13,000 years ago, would be severe droughts in the Middle East, which, of course, would have really difficult, complex political implications. That's one point. So this could happen. The chance of it happening, nobody knows.
Well, so let's go back into history here. You talk about a place that once existed called Doggerland. And
yes,
this is really fascinating because in some ways one could say that herein starts a whole climate story that is still continuing today.
Oh, indeed. This is absolutely fascinating because literally this whole saga of discovering Doggerland in any detail is a phenomenon of the last 20 years at the most. It all really began back in the 19th century when a very astute geologist realized that there were, in fact, sunken lands under the North Sea. And then in 1931, a fishing trawler on the Dogger, or Lemon and Oa Banks by the Dogger Bank, dredged up a bone harpoon, or sorry, an antler harpoon from the seabed. And this caused considerable interest because it made people realize that, in fact, this sunken land had been inhabited by humans. And then a series of other artifacts turned up, particularly off the Netherlands. And then in recent years, what's happened is they've got hold of the geophysical surveys done by oil companies looking for North Sea oil. And from this, they have developed maps of the topography of what was Doggerland. It was a sunken land. It was very, very swampy and marshy. It had lakes. It had rivers. And the configuration of rivers like the Tyne, Rhine, and the Thames was totally different to what it is now. And then there was higher ground, some low hills, which is now the Dogger Bank, which is the shallowest part of the North Sea. And this land was doomed. As sea levels rose between about 12,000 BC and about 5,000, 6,000 BC, Doggerland gradually vanished. And one of the fascinating stories of this whole business of rising sea levels is how people adapted to this, because we know now that there was probably a fairly small population in what is now the North Sea living in these swampy lands, which were paradise for people fishing and hunting because they were wetlands and there was all diversity of fish, game, everything. And they lived in small camps and they moved very readily. Because, I mean, you're in a situation where sea levels in some places may have risen 5 feet in a year, and other places where your parents had one coastline, and by the time you became of age, the coastline had changed completely. So you had to be very flexible, and these people were mobile, and they moved very readily. And as the North Sea flooded, it became islands, and then eventually Doggerland vanished, and the people moved up to high ground. This is very, very different from a situation today where you have millions of people living in cities like Shanghai who are faced with the same problem. And what do you do?
Exactly. That seems to be one of the core lessons of this book, The Attacking Ocean, Brian Fagan, you know, that back when people were doing hunting and fishing and gathering, they were far more resilient in their response to climate change. And you give the example of the introduction of agriculture in Japan. So take us back. Take us back to when Japan was connected to the mainland and then became an island, went through this period of a kind of paradise as well. And then what happened to make the Japanese so much more vulnerable to the attacking ocean than they were thousands of years ago?
The thing that makes all farmers more vulnerable is the fact that they're anchored to their land. And when you're anchored to your land, the whole dynamic changes. Your relationship to the environment changes. Your relationship to animals changes. Your relationship to each other changes because you live cheek by jowl in small villages. And you've got all sorts of issues which before, in a small band, you could settle if you quarreled by just moving away. And you get all these dynamics. And this makes moving a decision which depends on public opinion. It may depend on interceding with the ancestors who, of course, in many societies are the guardians of the land and therefore are held in considerable reverence. And you put all that together and you've got societies which had to adjust. They moved some of them to higher ground and so on. Because one of the things that's fascinating about Japanese early societies is it's clear they were well aware of the danger of tsunamis, which, as you know, are very, very prevalent in that part of the world. And they had a culture, an oral tradition apparently, which had people moving to higher ground. Directly there was a sign of a tsunami. And in some places, homeowned settlements are, or these farming settlements are on higher ground for that reason. So they adjusted in all sorts of ways. And of course, then you had the final difficulty, which is the problem of the relationship with your neighbors. In Doggerland, people were pretty scattered out. Probably they didn't meet more than 20 or 30 people in their lifetimes. But when you get people farming, you immediately have issues of who owns the land, who inherits the land, what happens if people want to marry in another community, what happens to the hunting grounds between, or fishing grounds between the communities. And you put all that together and you've got a set of very volatile and very complex social problems. And many of the consequences of agriculture weren't so much economic as they were political and social.
Hmm. So why didn't they just have their fields above the tsunami level?
How do you mean?
In other words, in Japan, you know, why didn't they just establish agriculture well away from what they knew would be recurring tsunamis?
Because of the fertile soils close to the coast, and also because of the fisheries, which were still very important. A lot of fields were on higher ground, but it was an extremely volatile situation. So they would try and stay above high ground, on high ground, if they could.
And did rice farming have something to do with this, with the introduction of that kind of farming? Doesn't that require a periodic flooding? Although it doesn't.
Then you get into another set of variables, mm-hmm. because rice, which came in a little later in Japan, and if you look at China, for example, people lived very, very low down, close to sea level. They were in a situation where there was flooding, but a lot of their villages were small, and they knew that their crops depended on fresh water. And if the sea level rose or there were tsunamis, their rice paddies would get ruined. So they would have to move. And again, there is evidence that they did so.
Now, a lot of people say, well, tsunamis, that has nothing to do with climate change. But, you know, after the tsunami in March of 2011 that hit the northern coast of Japan, I heard tell that there may be a relationship, as you've already alluded to, between, you know, changes in the Earth's crust as a result of the fact that, you know, the great ice sheets are melting, and prevalence of earthquakes. Is that something that you've come across at all?
No, I haven't, but I'm sure there are very complex relationships, because tsunamis, as you know, many of them are a result from Earth movements under the ocean, deep under the ocean. In fact, one of the factors which may have emptied or caused people to abandon Doggerland was a just-discovered tsunami off Norway back in about 6,000 BC, which apparently caused quite a lot of damage geologically. But, of course, tsunamis are not climatic events. But it's nonsense to say to dismiss them as unimportant in that context, because in a situation where you have higher sea levels, much more dense urban populations, and a danger of more extreme high tides and of storm surges and so on from climatic events like hurricanes, you really are in a situation where you're far more at risk from tsunamis than, say, were the early farmers of Japan, who were well aware of the phenomenon. And in fact, there's a case from Southeast Asia with the Aceh one some years ago, where a group of hunters on the Nicobar Islands saw the signs of a tsunami and moved to higher ground. They didn't lose a single person because their oral traditions told them what to do if certain phenomena were observed. And the elders observed them and made everybody move to higher ground in short order. But with higher sea levels, the damage wrought on densely populated coasts is much higher. So the cost to us in terms of vulnerability is a great deal more. So we really need to take tsunamis extremely seriously.
We're talking with Brian Fagan, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. His new book is The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. As you've just pointed out, you know, there are issues of sudden events that happen on top of underlying long-term trends, and that often that's a connection that's lost. I'd like to move to kind of the cradle of civilization, where you write about the changes there to Turkey, to the Mediterranean, to the creation of the Black Sea. Tell us some of that history. It's very fascinating.
It is indeed. What you've got are a series of very complex, often little known, often local things going on The most dramatic, of course, is the flooding of the North Sea, of the Black Sea, which was established, must be 15 years ago, by a group of oceanographers, where the sea level rising in the Mediterranean eventually broke through a huge natural berm, earthen berm, between what is now Turkey and Southeast Europe, and about 5500 BC, and burst through and flooded the Euxine Lake, as it was then, a freshwater or brackish lake, and turned it into the Black Sea. This caused the level of the Black Sea to rise. It must have caused considerable havoc to the farming communities who were farming on the margins of the Black Sea. And this may have even had an impact on people moving into the Danube Basin and into Europe. This was a major climatic event. But what is, from our point of view, really more immediate and more fascinating are areas like the Nile Delta. Back in the Ice Age, the last Ice Age, the Nile was a narrow, fast-flowing stream flowing through gorges and narrow valleys. Why? Because the sea level was very much lower than today. Then as the sea levels rose, the river ponded more slowly and started to form the Nile Delta. And the Nile Delta really didn't reach its modern configuration or near to it until about 5,000 years ago. And then, of course, during ancient Egyptian civilization, when sea levels were stable, it became the breadbox of ancient Egypt, a huge agricultural area, teeming with fish, very good for cattle, and indeed the really major economic engine for much of Rome's grain, and of course the hinterland of Alexandria, which is one of the great cities of the Greek world. And it continued to be this right into modern times. But now you've got sea levels rising, and at the same time you've got the population of Alexandria and Cairo and Egypt generally absolutely mushrooming. You've got drier conditions, and the result is, with the Aswan Dam having been built as well, you've got completely different regimen where the delta is gradually vanishing under rising sea levels. You've got overcrowding, you've got devastating damage to the oceanside swamps and mangrove swamps particularly, which preserve much of the coast. You've also, and this is serious, got seawater percolating into the groundwater, which is water for places like Cairo and Alexandria. And you've got a whole set of very complex things happening in a situation where tens of millions of people depend on the delta for food, water, and space to live. And the question comes up, what's going to happen in 50 to 100 years? Will we be confronted with the problem of moving large numbers of people elsewhere, environmental refugees? So you've got problems on that sort of scale, which we're only now beginning to really confront. And then you've got fascinating things like the configuration of the Piraeus in classical Athens completely changed. You've got studies of ancient Troy, of Homer's Troy, showing how the landscapes changed and how the old landscape has completely vanished, and so on and so forth. And it's kind of fun going through all these stories, that apart from Roman harbors and things like that.
This is the Radio EcoShock Show. You are listening to an interview by Francesca Rhiannon, host of the program Writer's Voice. She's talking with Brian Fagan, author of a new book about sea level rise. It's titled The Attacking Ocean. We'll be right back.